good afternoon, everyone. If we could settle down for the third talk. So we're more or less at the halfway point of the summer school. And, again, same question as asked before the last talk. Anyone volunteering to chair the discussion afterwards? Please? Pretty please? Oh, Bill, yeah, thank you. Yeah, all right then. Okay, so we'll sort that later on. So, very pleased to present Paddy Shannon giving a talk on The Vegans Are Coming.
Okay, well, I'm just going to start by asking, just out of curiosity, how many, I know about Lorna, but how many actual vegans are there in the audience? Hands up. Just the one. Any vegetarians in the audience? Okay. Oh, okay. So you like sausage, Brian, you said. Okay, good. Yeah. Tough audience then. Well, let me start by just saying that the title of this is it's partly a joke. All right. So I'm not going to stand here and start preaching about veganism and trying to make you all into vegans. That's not the purpose of this. That's not because I just want to annoy Lorna.
How about yourself? Are you vegan?
I am not a vegan myself. I am even wearing leather shoes, so I am not going to stand here and be hypocritical. I'm going to argue something. This the basis of this talk is a practical talk. It's not a moral talk. It's not an ethical talk, if you like. It's a practical talk. So, no, I'm not a vegan, but an estimated 30% of under 35s, I am thinking about it. So, to the point, what am I going to talk about this afternoon? 3 points. What are the facts, first of all? Secondly, what is the party's response? And thirdly, do we need to look at that? Do we need to change our attitude? Do we need to change our approach? Now, there's no denying that in the past 10 years or so, veganism has rocketed. It used to be a sort of weird, beardy food fad. But in the last few years, Tesco have said that demand for vegan and veggie products has shot up by 40%. That's just this year. UK vegans have gone from 150,000 10 years ago to 500,000 today. And those taking the vegan pledge, which is the pledge to do without meat for a year, meat or dairy for a year, has gone up from 3,600 in 2014 to 17,500 last year. Pret a Manger, which is a catering chain, opened 2 veggie-only restaurants recently and are seeing double-digit growth. Sainsbury's says, and I quote, "Plant-based eating is taking the health world by storm." And as I mentioned earlier, 30% of under 35s are considering trying a vegan diet. The statistics for this are from the Guardian, a Guardian article here, which you can come and inspect if you want. So that was quite a recent Guardian article. Well, so you might ask yourself, well, what's going on? What's all this about? I would say it's a generational thing. Most of the growth is amongst young people who, you know, for one reason or another, are less set in their ways and more willing to try new ideas, new ways of living. And veganism, because I'm going to conflate the two terms for most of this talk. Maybe that's cheating, but I'm going to do that anyway for reasons that you'll see. And it has quite a cool new image. Let's see if you can guess what connects Anne Hathaway with Avril Lavigne, Ariana Grande with Alanis Morissette, Anthony Hopkins with Anthony Perkins, Al Gore with Alicia Silverstone. Well, apart from the fact that they all begin with A, they're all vegans or vegetarians. And as you can imagine, the list goes right through to Z, and I couldn't be bothered to go even as far as B. So that's a lot of celebs and famous people. Okay, that's not an argument by itself, but it's an influence. Also, something that's also changed is the propaganda has changed. The propaganda for veggie veganism. If anybody here had the misfortune to watch the 2005 film Earthlings, they would have been quite horrified. It's a pretty horrible film. It's a depressing film. It focuses on basically how ghastly the meat industry is and how bad you should feel about it all. That was 10 years ago. Just this year, I don't know if anybody saw the BBC film Carnage recently, which was covered in The Standard. There was a review a couple of months ago in The Standard. Now, the message there is that vegan food is fun and that vegans can have a sense of humour. They can laugh at themselves. So the overall tone is much lighter than it used to be. It's not all about how ghastly the meat industry is. It's like, hey, it's okay to be vegan. It's quite fun. There's lots of celebs that do it. And it's, you know, the food's pretty good. So it's pretty easy to do nowadays. So overall, it's a much more positive message that's going across now. So Carnage makes the case through comedy, showing that, you know, vegans aren't all sort of dreary, self-righteous ascetics. This year, there's a new film coming out in the next couple of months, co-produced by James Cameron of Avatar, Titanic, Aliens, etc., etc. And also a guy called James Wilkes, who you may not have heard of, but who is currently the world champion mixed martial arts fighter. He's also vegan, and he's a vegan. What does this film say? Well, in the words of the director, the world's strongest guy is a vegan. The world's fastest guy, Carl Lewis, the first person to ever break 10 seconds, did it when he was a vegan. We're trying to dispel the myth that you need protein from animals to become a real man. Okay, well, that's perhaps not very PC. But once upon a time, not very long ago, Arnold Schwarzenegger could make a joke against Sylvester Stallone where he said, "You hit like a vegetarian," and it was quite a funny joke. But it's no longer so easy to mock when the world's mixed martial arts champion is a vegan. If you ever seen James Wilk, you just wouldn't pick a fight with that guy. So, still in all, why is all this happening all of a sudden? Well, there are two reasons. The one is the practical concerns about global warming and ethical concerns about how we ought to treat animals. Now, I'm going to take the latter question first, the ethical question. Most veggies I know are doing it for some form of ethical reasoning. But the trouble is, with ethical positions, is that they're not accountable to reason and they don't have to make sense. For example, if you think about this, you might eat meat, but then you might oppose bullfighting. You might keep a dog, but then you oppose animal circuses. You might like to go fishing, but you oppose fox hunting. You see what I mean? This is the problem with ethical positions. It's a long and complex debate. I don't propose to get into it for this talk. That's why I said it's a practical talk. I'm only going to talk about the practical arguments for the remainder of this talk. So, first off, the nutrition side of it. I think we can dispose of this quite quickly. As James Wilkes, the martial arts champion, can testify, you can be perfectly healthy on a veggie diet, and possibly even more so. Statistically, veggie diets are less associated with heart disease, you know, high cholesterol and all these sort of things. It's not a hard diet, it's not hard to do, it's not hard to cook veggie, and with all the veggie products that are around today and increasingly available, it's no one can really say that they don't know how to cook veggie. It's becoming easier and easier, and really, you know, for most people, there's no reason particularly to miss meat that much. Even vegan cheese hopefully might get better in the future. At the moment, it's like grated candle wax, so it's pretty grim. Okay, so that's the nutrition thing. I think, you know, we can take care of. It's not a nutritional issue. You don't need meat for that reason. We're omnivores anyway, humans, so we can eat anything. Now, the environment is the big argument. This is what I'm going to mainly lean upon. Now, I'm going to give you a few statistics. Now, I've got these in notes and various articles, you know, like these things. all of these statistics I'm going to give you, none of these come from vegan or vegetarian websites. They're all from either things like Scientific American, New Scientist, or the Food and Agricultural Organization. So they're not biased statistics, and I deliberately did that because sometimes vegans tend to exaggerate, like everybody else. Okay, so first of all, 26% of the world's ice-free surface is used for meat farming. So that's a quarter of the ice-free surface of the world, just for meat farming. Meat production has quadrupled in 50 years, from 308 million tonnes, and is expected to rise to 455 million tonnes by 2050. So it's clearly rising, and it's going to continue to rise. 14.5% of anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, which equates to 7 billion tonnes per year, are due to meat farming. The UK meat eater causes just over 7 kilos of carbon emissions per day, compared to 3.8 kilos for a vegetarian and 2.9 for a vegan. A kilo of beef causes more greenhouse gas emissions than driving for 3 hours while leaving all your lights on at home. 30% of all fish are fed to livestock. That's at a protein conversion rate of 3 to 1. So you're feeding 3 times the protein in to the amount of protein you're getting out. A kilo of grain-fed beef uses 100,000 kilos of water, whereas soya products take 2,000 kilos and wheat products take 900 kilos. And 65% of all nitrous oxide emissions, which is a greenhouse gas some 300 times more potent than carbon, is produced in livestock farming. Just got a couple more. Somebody recently, who's not here today, a member, said, oh, if we had a veggie planet, we'd be overrun by soya crops everywhere. In actual fact, 85% of soya crops are used for animal feed. 85%. So I think that disposes of that particular objection. And many of you will know there are vast animal ranches in the Amazon. The Amazon rainforest is one of the main cattle ranching regions of the world, with something like a 5 to 8% expansion of herds every year. Now, I did mention conversion rates 3 to 1 a little bit ago, and there's some confusion about this. If you go to vegan websites, this is where they tend to exaggerate a little bit sometimes. Now, conversion rates of vegetables to meat protein have been claimed to be something between 10 to 1 or 8 to 1, 8 protein. So that's 10 kilos of protein, veggie protein to 1 kilo of beef, this sort of thing. Now, we need to be careful with this sort of thing when we're looking at this in the Socialist Party, because we want to be kind of get the best figures. We don't want to believe what everybody says necessarily. The figure of 7 kilos of grain to 1 kilo of beef is touted by some vegans, but as far as from what I've worked out, this applies to intensive US feedlot farming. This is a particularly intensive type of farming where they basically ship high quality, high protein feed to the cows in these kind of lots, and then just stuff it down them. Now, that's a really expensive way to do it, but it's a high production intensive way to do it. Now, that doesn't mean that you couldn't do it cheaper. So let's establish that to begin with. There are cheaper ways to do this. If you grass feed cattle, it doesn't take 7 kilos. It still takes more, but it doesn't take 7 kilos. There are discussions ongoing amongst government departments and the Food Agricultural Organization about how to get this ratio down. One suggestion from UK government researchers in 2016, which is pretty gross, was to feed cattle on maggots, very high protein. They've been talking a lot about that. I don't know if you've read that in the newspaper about cricket bars. You know, you can eat these kind of like sort of, you know, snack bars that are made out of ground up crickets. Super high protein, but the yuck factor is something you've got to get over. So one other thought is, well, okay, don't feed it to humans, but feed this stuff to animals, super high protein, and it comes up the food chain, so we eat it in the end. But less, you know, people will be like to be less revolted by that. But however you dice it, or you cut it, or you slice it, or beat it, or mince it, or whatever, meat farming, I contend, is an inefficient way to create food, because you're putting more protein into the process than you're getting out at the end. Now, if we're thinking about running a socialist food production system, would we go about it in that way, logically, putting more protein in than we're getting out? Well, I suggest no, that would be silly and pointless. If our focus is on making sure that people are fed, that would be a very odd way of going about it. Now, as everybody knows, the world's developing countries, in particular China and India, are aspiring to a Western lifestyle, which includes a meat-heavy diet. So when you consider what I've just said about the statistics I mentioned earlier, 26% of the ice-free surface of the Earth devoted to meat farming, that's now. Imagine what happens when 1.4 billion Chinese would start expecting 3 meat meals a day, and 1.2 billion Indians expect 3 meat meals a day. I have some charts here just on this. Here's a picture of the expected increase in population by 2050. Now, I think you can see that. It's very simple, isn't it? That's where we are. That's where we're expected to be by 2050. That's how many extra people are expected to need to feed. This is where these people are. This one is Asia, and this is sub-Saharan Africa. This is where the growth is. All these others is Europe down here. They're not going to change much, but this is where the growth is. Okay, and these are the people who are expecting a Western lifestyle like we enjoy. You know, the sort of dinners that we have, they expect too, and why not? I'll just show you a couple of other charts. Here's what people are eating over the amount of protein that they really need. Okay, that middle line there is the amount of protein that is the suggested amount of protein that you need, you know, daily. And here is here's the excess of what people are eating, broken down by various areas. So, as you won't be surprised to learn that the US is the top one there, you can see. That's how much extra protein people are eating over what they really need. I don't know if you know this about protein, but if the body doesn't use protein straight away, excuse me, I'm a bit of a diet bore at the moment because I'm doing this stupid low-carb thing. It's interesting, but it makes me even more boring than I normally am. But I discovered this. If you consume more protein than you really need, your body converts it to fat. It has got no use for it, so it just converts it to sugars, which then get translated into fat. Next to the US, you've got, there we go, that's the European Union, surprise, surprise. And the rest are OECD countries, Brazil, Russia, Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, not so much, and India down there, not so much. But these are the ones, as you recall, those ones that are not taking too much protein there are also the same ones that have got the biggest growth, projected growth here.
Okay. What's the green bit? Is that vegetable protein?
What's the what, sorry?
The green bit at the bottom.
What is it? Yes, it's plant-based protein. So it's what people are getting for... That's the vegetable protein, and that's all the meat protein. Okay. So, okay. Going back to having done the pictures... I'll just show you one more. There we go. I was going to stick these up, but I didn't have any blue tack, so I'm just going to do it like this. Okay, greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, share of global environment impact from 2010. So it's a little bit old, but... Okay, so that's greenhouse gas from agriculture. That's land mass, 37% of all land mass, without excluding Antarctica. That's agriculture. This is not... You remember I said 26% was for meat. This is 37% for all agriculture. Okay. And this is water use. As you can see, it's absolutely gigantic. It's massive. It's three quarters, nearly. Okay. All right. So we're not going to abolish agriculture, obviously. It's a question of how we use agriculture, what we do with it, and what's the most sensible use of it. And so my argument, as I think you can probably guess by now, is meat production is not the most sensible use for agriculture. So the argument is that the world can't afford the meat production industry as it currently exists. But I ought to include a caveat with that, which is that vegetarianism or veganism, if you like, it's not a magic cure-all. Now, some people, like to dismiss it as if to say, oh, you just think that's going to, solve the world's problems. Nobody's saying that. In fact, from a socialist perspective, I think probably a lot of you would suspect, and I also think, if the world did go vegetarian, as, for example, the United Nations has been asking for since 2010, and the Stern report before that has been recommending that the world goes towards a vegan diet, even if that were the case, the land that was freed up from meat production wouldn't necessarily go to feed people. We're talking about capitalism here. We're not talking about feeding people because they're hungry. We're talking about feeding people who've got the money to pay for it. And if people don't have the money to pay for food, that land will get used for something else that's more profitable, most likely biofuels. So veganism isn't a solution to capitalism's food production problems. But I would argue it is a potential part of the solution for a socialist alternative. So that's what I'm going to argue. So I'm not saying this is going to change anything, particularly in capitalism. Capitalism doesn't care about feeding people, as you know. It cares about making money. And it won't necessarily do that just because everybody decides to go without their sausage. Now, I think I have met vegans who understand this. They really do. You know, they've got their eyes open, they've got their feet on the ground, they understand how the world works. Now, to those kinds of vegans, I say, well, you need to look at the socialist alternative. If you really want a lasting solution to this, it's a socialist solution. It's not something you're going to find on a vegan website. However, there are other vegans who are idealistic and a bit, especially ethical vegans, I think that they're not really rooted in the practicalities of the question. They're more difficult to argue with. Now, I think that when we ask vegans and vegetarians and whatnot to be, reasonable and think about practicalities and to be open-minded and consider the socialist case, in return, as socialists, we need to be open-minded to them. We need to listen to what they've got to say. We need to consider whether they've got an argument that we ought to take on board. So this is where I come to the second part of the talk, which is, what is the party's current position on this? Now, to illustrate this current party position, which is not, by the way, a stated, agreed conference decision or anything like that, it's more of a default position, something that we've kind of gone along with for years without really discussing that much. Well, I'm going to quote from Material World in the Social Standard from April 2017 this year. Many pressers to promote vegetarian diets and organic agricultural methods as the key and become disgruntled when we do not make it party policy and commit ourselves to such a view. However, it cannot be for the few socialists that there are currently to usurp the democracy of those who have the task of implementing socialism around the planet by decreeing what is an acceptable solution to a social problem and what is not. Now, I'll just remind you of some of the key terms there. Many pressers, it's not in my experience, it's many, that vegetarian diets are the key. I've never heard anyone argue that. To usurp the democracy, that's quite inflammatory language if you think about it. And decreeing what is an acceptable solution. Decreeing? Really? Is that what we do in the Socialist Party? Decree things? I don't think so. Now, I would argue that this language doesn't imply impartiality at all. This is not a fair treatment of what the vegetarian argument is, and it's not a fair treatment of what the vegetarian argument in the Socialist Party ought to be. Now, nobody's pressing anybody in the Socialist Party to promote vegetarianism as the key to anything. At the most, you could say, if it's a key, Maybe it's like a piano key, amongst a lot of keys. A lot of keys that you need to play a tune. Perhaps it's that kind of key. But it's certainly not a key to open a door or unlock socialism or any of that sort of thing. Now, it seems to me that the logic of this statement that was in the standard, taken literally, implies that we actually can't really say anything at all about socialism. We can't usurp the democracy of the future by decreeing that, say, there'll be no famines in socialism, or that there'd be no wars. We can't even decree that socialism should be democratic, or that it should have abolished property-owning elites, or trade. Well, now, of course, you'll immediately say, hang on a minute, that wouldn't be socialism. And you'd be quite right, it wouldn't. But socialism comes with a set of specifications. And one of those specifications is, I would argue, it must be sustainable. Now, if we avoid decreeing that unsustainable practices should be discontinued in socialism, I suggest that we're not actually describing socialism at all. We're describing a form of idealised socialism with all the bad bits taken out, all the bits that we don't really want to think about. Now, that kind of socialism isn't a real picture of socialism. It's a sort of, well, I hate to say it, but it's a kind of utopia. So the party position is that the veggie debate is a lifestyle choice. It's a personal choice. It has nothing to do with class war. It has nothing to do with socialism. It's not a question that the Socialist Party need concern itself with. And I contest that position. Now, I hope I've made the point by now that food production has got everything to do with socialism, and that, therefore, this goes way beyond lifestyle choices. It's a question of sustainability. If something is unsustainable, we should just come right out and say so. And it's also not true that there's no class angle. Let me give you two examples. Firstly, when you consider that the conditions that a lot of slaughterhouse workers experience round the world, they're quite appalling. They're some of the worst conditions, they're some of the most dangerous conditions of any jobs anywhere in the world. In many places, certainly in the United States, many chicken farms are staffed by illegal immigrants who are trafficked in. They're given no rights, given very low pay. If they try to organise, they're sacked or they're beaten up, or they're sort of handed over to the authorities who then deport them. So they live in fear, they work in fear. The cases of industrial accidents, you have to read the statistics to believe how bad it is. In one chicken farm, there were 750 amputations in a 13-year period in one chicken farm. I won't go into this any further, but just to suffice to say that when we're talking about meat production, we're not simply talking about how the animals suffer. We can also be talking about how the workers suffer. It's quite hideous industry in many places in the world because it's unregulated, because people don't know what's going on, because people don't care what's going on, because as long as they get their packaged chicken in Sainsbury's or wherever it is, they don't have to think about how it's produced, and the conditions are quite horrific. In fact, some of the most brutal on the planet. You could say that, well, okay, in socialism it wouldn't be like that. We wouldn't have those conditions. And that's true. I think that's absolutely true. But socialism is a voluntary society. It would only be volunteers working in the slaughterhouse. But I would ask you to ask yourself, would you volunteer to work in a slaughterhouse? I know I wouldn't. I couldn't bring myself to do that. So ask yourself, could you do it? Secondly, the other aspect of the class, how class is involved in this, is what are we to say to workers around the world about equality and equality of access in a socialist world while we're tucking into our stakes over here knowing that they not only can't afford them today, but they couldn't even afford them in socialism because the world, the planet couldn't afford it in socialism. What are we to say to them about equality? It's okay for us to have this stuff, but I'm sorry, you have to do without. And you still have to do without in socialism because the world can't, the planet can't cope with it. Well, are they going to see us as socialist comrades then? Are they going to see us as on the same side as them? Or are they going to see us as elitist? You know, are they going to see us as actually the class enemy? We're demanding something for ourselves that we've a right to eat, and they haven't. So I think there's a question there about class solidarity. We can't tell the workers one thing and then privately do the complete opposite. I don't see how we're going to get world socialism by behaving like that. So, now I think that the party has traditionally sort of dismissed the meat debate, you know, if you like, because it makes us feel uncomfortable. This is about personal choices. This is about lifestyle. This is about, you know, the personal is political. You know, part of the party sort of quite often feels quite uneasy about this sort of discussion. And because people feel threatened by it, people often, you know, I've experienced as well, people, you know, meat eaters are often quite hostile to, you know, vegetarians. In the film Carnage, there's quite a good bit where, quite a funny bit, where this sort of pro-meat guy goes around to a cafe with just lentils on the menu and he says, "Oh, do you eat this stuff because you're worried that you're not smug enough?" We got, and there was and chefs notoriously are famous for hating vegetarians. One chef called Anthony Bourdain, he said in 2000, "Vegetarians and their Hezbollah-like splinter faction, the vegans, are a persistent irritant to any chef worth a damn." Well, I would say 17 years on, the boot's on the other foot, and it's actually chefs that won't cater for vegetarians who are not worth a damn. Now, maybe this is something that, you know, we need to face up to as a party. Members need to face up to this. The fact is that attitudes change, and attitudes have changed over this. The wider world is taking a different view of this. Whether we do or not, doesn't matter. They are taking a different view. I told you about the figures of the rise in veganism over the last 10 years. It's absolutely massive. The major chain stores are bringing in new products all the time because of this. And yet, where are we? How are we responding to this? Now, we know that members, at one point, at some time in the past, you know, let's be honest, you know, we were individual members who might have been sexist, maybe even racist. Certainly, we've known one or two in, you know, deep and dark history were homophobic. Well, you know, let's not be too surprised about that. It's not good. It's not what we stand for. But let's not be too amazed, because we're human beings. We're a product of our time. We do our best. You know, we have a rationale. We have a rational think. We're also very good at deceiving ourselves and making excuses for ourselves. So let's not beat ourselves up about this sort of thing. But let's also admit that is true. That is true. There have been people in the party like that in the past. Now, maybe those people justified their attitudes at that time to themselves as private and personal. That had nothing really to do with the party. In other words, it was a lifestyle choice. Maybe it was the same with all of these sort of little prejudices. But it wasn't the Socialist Party case that changed those people, actually. It should have done. It should have done. But they had these little attitudes, these legacy attitudes, if you like. Despite the Socialist Party case, despite the organisation they were in, they still had those legacy issues. What changed that? Well, I would say the wider society changed that. The wider society moved on. The wider society dealt with homophobia. Today, if you talk to young people about homophobia, they don't understand what the issue is. They just don't get it. And I know this because I've done this in jobs that I've had. They just don't see an issue. It's like, who cares? It's gone. Now, but I've met members who, in the past, who, I can remember, members who spoke out against mobile phones, hated them, really hated them, resented them, but this intrusion of technology. Five years later, they all had mobile phones and they were using them. I remember one particular one, I won't say who it was, really vociferous against mobile phones, but then his mobile phone went off in the middle of one of my talks. I thought it was quite funny, you know. So times change, you know, and it doesn't change just... We don't necessarily change. We probably stay the same, but the outside world changes. There was a talk that was mentioned this morning of recycling. Now, I can remember, again, members really antagonistic to the idea of recycling. They would say, well, look at the industries, look at the amount of waste that they do. They don't care. Why should we do anything? It's not our responsibility. It's capitalism, you know. And it's a bit of a cop-out, isn't it, you know, to say that. It's a bit of a cop-out, you know. You personally have got no responsibility, just not even a little bit, surely. I mean, I would guess probably most people here, you know, do domestic recycling, and why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you? Because do you want to live in a world where people don't give a shit, or do you want to live in a world where people actually make a little bit of effort and put their stuff in a recycle bin? So we do it. Now, that's not us that's changed. That's not our idea that's changed. That's the outside world that's changed us. Now, I suggest the same thing is happening with the meat question. And we also saw that, and by the way, you can probably remember, some of you, a big argument in the party years ago about a smoking ban. We weren't bloody well not being going to be told what to do by the state. We were going to smoke in head office and if we wanted to, damn right. And who the hell are they to tell us what we can do and what we can't do? Can you smoke in head office today? No. Does anybody smoke in head office today? No. I once did it in the kitchen smoking out the window and I properly got told off, I'm not kidding, by a party member who was right. I shouldn't have been doing it. It was naughty. So we've not changed. We've been changed by the wider society around us. Now, this is where my theme is going. The wider society is changing its attitude to meat. We are not. But I think we need to. Because what happens is, if wider society changes and we don't, we're catching up with society. That's not a role for a revolutionary organisation. We shouldn't be playing catch-up. We should be in front. We should be saying to people, look, this is where you need to come. This is where you need to go. We shouldn't be running up behind, like tail-end Charlie, constantly catching up with society because it's changing its views and we haven't. That's not what a revolutionary organisation does. That's not who we are. And if we don't change, I suggest, if we awkwardly absent ourselves from this debate about meat because we insist that this is a lifestyle change, when we can see the statistics about the environment, we can see what the harm that's being done to the in terms of climate change, and the carbon footprint of meat production, if we refuse to deal with this and insist that this is a lifestyle change, I think that all we're doing is helping to make ourselves more and more irrelevant to wider society. And that is a very damaging thing for us to do, when we're trying to be the most relevant thing that the working class can look at. We're making ourselves out of date. Now, I come to the third question, which is, do we need to change our approach? Okay, and I think you can probably guess what my answer to this is, but I'm going to just talk you through it anyway. Now, I heard a statement the other day. I go to a little writing club, and somebody said to me that there are two types of writers. There are planners and there are pantsers. Planners are people, obviously, who plan it all out, and you know, before they write a word. And there are people who just kind of like start on page one and go by the seat of the pants. You've got to be a pretty good writer to go by the seat of the pants, because I can't do that because it just goes all over the place and then down the toilet. But planners and pantsers, two types of writers. Now, what I think is, the world is not a novel and you can't just rewrite it when you fuck it up. You need to get it right, and you need to plan it. So what we need to be as a socialist party is we need to be planners. And I think at the moment we're pantsers. We're looking at the world around us and going, oh, you know, they're changing their ideas on smoking. Oh, maybe we should do something. Oh, look, you know, the world's changing its ideas on recycling. Oh, maybe we should respond. Oh, look, you know, now everyone's talking about meat and veganism. Oh, you know, maybe we should think about this. We're pantsers. We're not planners. We're following. We should be in front, not behind, as I said before. Now, I promised you that I wasn't going to try and turn you all into vegans, and I would have absolutely fat chance of that anyway. But I'm not even going to try. It's asked, and I'm not going to try, because it's asking too much of the working class in general. But not only have they got to adopt the whole socialist view with all that goes with it, but also they've got to give up the bloody sausages and burgers. Jesus, it's hard enough as it is. We can't make it even more difficult. Okay, so that's why I'm not going to do that. And anyway, logically, if we were going to do that, we'd have to also say, well, you know what? You're going to have to ask people to give up all the other things that are probably not very sustainable. I mean, consider air conditioning. Air conditioning in this country, why do we even need it? But you get air conditioning in cars nowadays and this sort of thing. But it's very fuel intensive. You know, air conditioning in offices, just open a window, for God's sake. But, you know, this sort of thing, it's not sustainable around the world. India and China, they all want air conditioning. So they're huge, power-hungry sort of things. Would we have to tell workers where you can't have that? Well, OK, in this country, air conditioning is not a big deal. But what about washing machines? What about dishwashers? Dishwashers, the amount of water you use to just wash a few dishes that you could just do in the sink. All right? Dishwashers. What about car driving? Car, you know, get a bus. Pet owning. Pet owning. You wouldn't think that was a big deal, but the amount that there's an area the size, roughly the size of Japan, is used to produce the food that's fed to pets. Okay, I read entertainingly not long ago that you could drive two SUVs, 10,000 kilometres each, for the price of one average sized dog. One dog. Two SUVs, 10,000 kilometres. Okay? Pet owning is not very sustainable. Are we going to tell workers they can't have pets? Okay? So you've got to draw the line somewhere. Okay. So what can we do then? Well, this is where I'm concluding now. You'll be delighted to hear. We can make positive statements about the growth of awareness of meat farming and its impacts. Okay? We can agree with everyone else, the wider society, yes, this is bad for the environment. Yes, this is not sustainable. Yes, we need a solution to this. We can choose to not ignore this debate, but we can join in with it. Other things that we can do. We can agree, I think, amongst ourselves, that, all right, we're not all going to be vegan, but we can try and reduce meat consumption, because reducing is at least better than doing nothing. And this is where this is the reason why I've conflated veganism with vegetarianism, and why I've still got my leather boots on and all that stuff. I'm not being hypocritical about here. I'm just talking about reducing, not, you know, going cold turkey, if that's the phrase. It's probably an unfortunate pun. but reducing. We can agree as a party this is a good idea, and we can put this in our writing. We can actually say, actually, this is a good idea. Let's reduce. Let's do that. Okay, because everyone else is saying this anyway, so we're not doing anything revolutionary, we're just following everyone else. Okay, we could maybe get enthusiastic about new developments like in vitro meat. Have you heard of this? This is lab grown meat. This is in vitro. Okay, so it's called in vitro. Now, this is an interesting development. It might work. At the moment, it's really badly underfunded. You can go to the website and look, and they're like desperate for money. For technical reasons, you know, to do with funding, funders have ring fencing systems, and in vitro meat just unfortunately sits between two ring fences, so it just doesn't get the investment. The first in vitro meat, if you probably remember reading about this in a few years ago, I can't remember. This cost €300,000 to make one burger, and it took a year to make it. Now, this process might scale up. That's the exciting possibility. It might scale up. Now, if it does, you know, you can like kick the whole vegan argument out the window. This is a technical solution to, if you like, a moral stroke ethical problem. So technology might come to the rescue. But if it doesn't, or it can't scale up, we need to stop being afraid of the question. We need to stop being afraid of suggesting that socialism could well be a low meat production society. I think we should be able to say that in print and not be afraid of it. Now, if we engage in the argument instead of avoiding it, we could actually put the case for meat production as well. Right, now, here's something I bet you didn't think I was going to say. We can explore the argument that some farmers put is that there are some areas of land, especially high where I live in Lancashire, the high fells, stony, windy, not good for crops. There's not much you can do with land like that except put sheep on them. Okay? We can argue the case that in some areas of the world, meat production makes the best sense. You can't do anything else with that land. Well, let's look at that argument. Let's say, all right, well, there can be limited meat production, perhaps, if it makes sense. We can look at these meat conversion ratios that I mentioned earlier, where you're putting in more protein than you're getting out. We can look at that and see if we can make that more efficient. How could that be done? We could consider the argument that when we're talking about meat production, not all types of meat are equivalent. Now, the two... I did have a chart and I seem to have lost it. The two vastly, far and away, the most carbon-intensive, water-intensive, power-intensive types of meat are lamb, first, lamb and goats, and secondly, beef cattle. But beef cattle is hugely the most impactful just because there are so many herds. It's huge. It's just enormous. There's something like 13 domestic animals to every human alive on the planet today. It's vast. We can look at that. We can say, comparatively, pigs and chickens are very small impact. They're actually very cheap to run. That's actually a very efficient way to do meat compared to the ovines and the bovines. It's very efficient. So we could say, we're not saying no meat, but let's look at the different types of meat and see what's sustainable and what's not. Okay. We could look at also the Food and Agricultural Organization's conclusion in their report from, I think it was 2015, that today's, I'm paraphrasing roughly, but today's meat industry could cut its carbon emissions by 30% if it was just more efficiently run. Now, whether it could be more efficiently run in capitalism is open to question, but could it be more efficiently run in socialism? Hell yes. And we can also, I think, look at the ethical side of things, and we can look at the rise in veganism and ask ourselves, is this an indicator of ideas that are changing, with perhaps a view to working out whether workers are becoming more receptive to socialist ideas? When you consider that if young workers in particular, is young workers, if they're beginning to think of the idea of animal exploitation as fundamentally and ethically unacceptable, what about their ideas of human exploitation? Wouldn't you expect those to change as well? So if young people are beginning to think it's wrong to exploit and abuse and cruelly abuse animals, we can respond by saying, yes, we agree. And it's also wrong to cruelly exploit and abuse human beings. And we would expect an agreement. So if we engage with this discussion, and we can engage with these new movements in society, these new ideas in society, we could perhaps find a new audience that we're not currently tapping. And we can also discuss, if you want, and I haven't dealt with this in this debate, deliberately so, the ethical debate, but we can look at that. We can look at what we really think about animals. Right? Humans' view of animals has changed over thousands of years. And until fairly recently, animals were regarded as just meat machines without any feeling, any capacity for pain, any cognition whatsoever, simply burgers on legs. Now that's changing because science has, over the last few years, 20 years, changed so much, changed our ideas of what animals actually are. So now we know that, for example, dogs have a sense of justice. Swans go and have extramarital affairs. Chimpanzees steal and then lie to you about what they've done and try to diddle you out of things. We know that elephants also have a sense of honesty. Now, we know these things now about animals, and much more is being learned. And the old idea that these are just burgers on legs that we use and eat and kill and don't care about is beginning to change. And we can look at that argument as well, if we're not afraid of the debate. We can do all of this as long as we stop avoiding the debate. Now, at the moment, I suggest that we've got a head-in-the-sand approach about this whole subject. It doesn't have to mean that we all become miserable vegan ascetics with no sense of humour. What it does mean is that we can engage with this practically, we can talk about socialism in practical terms, and we can talk to young people and how they're changing their ideas, and we can talk to them in their own language and show that we're still a relevant relevant force in society. And also we can reduce. So next time you fancy a lamb vindaloo, just think about this. Actually, the veggie equivalents taste just as good. Thank you.